Welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team.
This week on the show, the August volatility has died down just a bit. But in the meantime, two portfolio managers from New Jersey have done a lot of research on how economic imbalances between the U.S. and China will resolve themselves and how investors should position for what's to come.
And of course, we'll close out the episode with our tradition, the craziest thing I saw in markets this week. And if you're listening at home and you notice something crazy, by all means, call our hotline at 646-324-3490 and leave us a voicemail about the craziest thing you saw in markets. Or if you have a question for the hosts or the guests, put that on a voicemail too, and maybe we'll play it on air. But as you said, we have two portfolio managers here from Washington Crossing Advisors, which is a subsidiary of Stifel Financial Corp. And Sarah, as you mentioned, two Jersey guys, that makes three Jersey guys and you on the show.
I'm the odd one out.
So, you know, warning, things could get a little weird.
Yeah.
You know, if we start arguing about where to get the best pork roll.
That's when I leave the room.
That's when, yeah, we'll just edit that out later. Or what the best rest stop is, maybe. I don't know. There's a lot we can get into.
But really important information.
But here they are. Let's introduce them now. First, from Washington Crossing Advisors, he started out, 28 years ago at Gruntel & Company. His name is Chad Morgenlander. Chad, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on.
And I believe you started with our other guest, Kevin Caron, around that same time at Gruntel. Now you're both at Washington Crossing Advisors. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so 28 years you guys have known each other. There must be some good stories to hear.
There is.
We're like an old married couple.
But tell us about the firm you guys are helping to run now. Basically, from my understanding, it's about $3.5 billion in assets in separate accounts, and you have three or four different strategies? Does that sound about right, Kevin?
Sure. We come at investing from a couple different points of view, and we look at the top-down macro environment, and we're also looking at individual stocks and bonds from a bottom-up fundamental perspective. And we think that bringing all of this together is a very good way to have a holistic and comprehensive view of how to structure and put together a portfolio. So we've hammered these disciplines out over the last 30 years, more or less, and we've found some ways that we can really help investors in a unique way to do things maybe a little bit differently with their portfolios.
So tell us about this research you guys have been doing into China. I mean, clearly the whole financial world is dead focused on China these days. What approach did you guys take, and sort of what are the main takeaways of the research you've been doing?
Yeah, so it's a big investment topic, obviously, and it is one that has become very much politicized. There's a lot of about this topic because the economies are so big, so diverse, and the history of these imbalances, which is really we're talking about the large sustained trade and capital account balances between our two countries, have been so big for so long, we thought it would be really good to take a step back, really try to just look at the history of this without a political bias to it, and try to just to unwind where we came from and try to draw some investment implications about where we go forward. And to the bottom line of it for us is that debt levels have soared as a result of this. And we want to be very careful with owning companies that have lots of debt on their balance sheets. And then secondly, we think that this has had a significant influence on global interest rates. And we want to be prepared in having a portfolio that can respond to what we see as a eventual period of rising interest rates around the world.
You guys wrote a three-part series of research notes, and I was fascinated by the first one. And the title being the U.S.-China trade mess, How Did We Get Here? I mean, how did we get here, actually? Tell us what you guys found.
Well, 40 years ago, we had a China that was vastly different than it was today. It was a very, very backwards country in a lot of ways. It was underinvested in a lot of ways. And policies were put in place at that point, which really removed a lot of restrictions and allowed China throughout the 1980s and early 1990s to begin to develop more towards its potential. that was a very good period of growth for China, and it really did help China to really begin to get some momentum. And then as we came into the 1990s, that continued, but we started to see China not making the transition to the kind of developed country that most other developed countries are. Specifically, when you look at the population, the average person in China earns about $10,000 a year, and the degree to which those consumers are willing to spend is still very, very depressed, making China a bit of a contradiction. On the one hand, China would like to be considered one of the largest countries on the planet, and by some measures they are. But when you look at the standards of living and the income for the average Chinese person, they're nowhere near where the United States is or the many developed countries where incomes are anywhere from $50,000 to $60,000 to $70,000 a year per capita. So that was really kind of that was a big part of this. It had to do with China not fully making the transition to an open economy and having an economy that's very much based upon domestically driven investment, but it has not been fully shared by China's household sector, which is subsidizing a lot of the investments that are generating the growth. And it's ultimately not sustainable. It's something that we're concerned about.
Right. And it seems like something that can't be fixed overnight, that it would take decades, years, if not decades, to work its way through. I mean, and meanwhile, President Trump is kind of operating on an election cycle timeline. Where do you see it all? I mean, will progress be made, do you think? Are we putting the right pressure? Is the U.S. putting the right pressure on China to sort of fix the issues you're seeing, that the consumer in China is not really at the level it should be as far as income and wealth?
Well, the pressures are coming from not just the United States, not just this administration. If you think about where we've come, you've had very large capital flows coming from a developing nation into a very developed nation, the United States. And the United States got to a point where we had a tremendous buildup of debt leading up to the financial crisis, a doubling of our national debt following the financial crisis that led to a downgrade of our debt in 2011 by Standard & Poor's. So we had a very significant ramp up of debt, which has been a significant burden on the U.S. economy. And at the same time, our growth rate, particularly in manufacturing, has been much less than it otherwise could have been. So what started out as a good thing for the U.S. consumer, lowering of inflation rates, the availability of cheap Chinese goods, really did help solve some of our inflation problems in the 70s. But it has now gotten to the point where the pendulum has fully swung. And what was originally a good thing for both China and the United States has now become a bit of a burden with a lot of dead weight loss and drag, which is weighing on the global economy in various ways. So some of this is just a natural pushback against a process that's been many years in the making.
And some of the issues that you have now is that China needs to readjust. Unfortunately, the fragility of the economy there is as they readjust, you can see it within their growth rates as well as within the financial markets. Unfortunately, though, this also flies in the face of communism and the political party. They are unwilling to allow the free flow of capital. And by doing that, it has created this massive distortion that Kevin's talking about.
One thing I think pops out at me, and correct me if I'm misinterpreting your guys' work, but you really believe that this global regime of ultra-low interest rates is not here to stay, that it will reverse eventually. Sort of paraphrase from the China report, ultra-low interest rates are unlikely to persist, and the savings glut is unsustainable. I mean, that's a big deal, I think. Obviously, we have this aging population around the world contributing to this massive savings glut, big reason why yields are so low around the world. What do you see that makes you think that that will reverse, and sort of what's the timeline of that?
Well, the globe, we're following very much in the tradition of what Ben Bernanke laid out in mm-hmm. the framework of the global savings glut. But the reality is it's not so much a global savings glut, because at the level of planet Earth, the savings and investment do balance. What you're seeing is a glut of savings in one region of the world, particularly the emerging markets led by China, in a that savings has to go somewhere, and it has to go to the developed nations around the world, including the United States. So this is something that ultimately it doesn't go on forever. And what ultimately we would expect to have happen is we would have all of these things that are happening: the financial crisis, the buildup of debt in the Western world, the buildup of debt within China. If those investments, particularly in China, that are being put in place, are not funded internally by cash flows that they can generate, then ultimately that's going to lead to problems. Credit growth that is not productive. There's no experience in history that I know of that has sustained that kind of growth indefinitely. So ultimately, that tends to lead to problems. And if it was Latin America in the 70s and 80s or Japan, ultimately that reverses. And there's two ways for that to happen. It can either be a period of a slow process of very low growth in China, where they rebalance, growth comes down, consumer growth picks up. You have a rise of a consumer class in China, perhaps 10 years from now, very different than where it is today. Or at some point, if this continues, then those imbalances and the amount of non-productive credit becomes a problem, and then you eventually have some kind of debt problem that we have to contend with. So it can either happen slowly or it can happen all at once.
So the point is that interest rates aren't going higher overnight over the course of the next 3 to 6 months. You still have to go through this glide path. And if they decide not to at least acclimate themselves to normalcy, then you're going to see potentially that China dislocation that China bears think about. We're hoping that that won't occur, that over a longer period of time of 5, 10, 15 years, they're going to start rebalancing their economy. Overall, interest rates right now are going to stay lower for this period of time. So if you're a long-only portfolio manager, you still want to continue to be in bonds.
So to me, it seems like when people talk about risks right now, when people think about the situation in China, they think about it as something separate from the idea of extremely low interest rates, low bond yields. You have an inverted yield curve. We saw it once again this week. People think of them as separate situations. Would you say that's kind of wrong in a way you can intertwine the two and say one is related to the other?
Certainly. You cannot look at things today as they were in the past. And we're very aware of the inverted yield curve and the historical record of the inverted yield curve. But you've got some very different things today. You have different market structures. You have the existence of negative yields elsewhere in the world, which we've never had before. You've had very repressive interest rate regimes around the world. And you still have the savings glut that exists. So it's too easy just to say history will repeat, but the inverted yield curve is something that we as portfolio managers have to be sensitive to, because it does change to a certain extent the incentives to borrow and lend, and there is this historic tendency for it to be a precursor of recessions in many cases. We just need to see other things begin to get worse in the data that we're looking at. We haven't seen that yet. Yes, the foreign data in many cases doesn't look so good, but here in the United States, data looks pretty good, and therefore we're remaining overweight in our allocation to U.S. equities versus overseas, but no big changes yet.
So you guys have what you call the WCA Fundamental Conditions Barometer. And for a good chunk of the year, let's see, from November to April, it was at a level below 50, which you say is a heightened risk of recession. Now in August, it's back up to 62, so above that sort of 50 dividing line. What are sort of the inputs of this indicator, and why is it doing so well right now compared to earlier in the year?
So we have 30 inputs that go into it. 10 are credit indicators, U.S. domestic, 10 are international, as well as 10 are U.S. economic. And right now, actually, the barometer is around 50. So we're equally weighted between stocks and bonds at this point from our last reading. Overall, we're looking at things like credit spreads, indicators of that nature, U.S. auto sales, economic activity here. And what we're seeing is that the U.S. economy is doing okay-ish. It's decelerating, and we're looking at a 2% handle on GDP to 2.25%. The pressure is coming from international economic data points, from international, as well as credit, that are the ones that are showing some softness at this point. But overall, our global GDP expectation is that it's going to continue to decelerate. U.S. economic activity, we believe, going into 2020 will continue to decelerate. But we're seeing a modest increase, modest probability of a recession, a little higher. But overall, we're not calling for a recession at this point.
That's interesting. So this report was like in mid-July. I think it was like 62. Then it's come down pretty quick to about 50 now, you say.
Yeah, so, I would say so, about 55.
So a coin toss.
50-50. It's been pretty clear that we've seen a slowdown in the manufacturing sector, and people have been looking at the services numbers saying, is this going to potentially bleed over? Well, this past Thursday, we did get some market PMI data. You saw the manufacturing numbers come in at 49.9, so slightly in contractionary territory. And you saw services slip as well to really just above 50. Yeah, I mean, you could say it's one number. You can't look at it in a vacuum. But does something like this put you on edge at all?
Well, as Chad just mentioned, in the last month or so, our barometer has come down just a little bit towards the first downtick in several months, as a matter of fact. And it is manufacturing tied to the global economy that is driving that. On the other side of that, when you look at the U.S. consumer, it remains very strong. So if we look at retail sales, we look at income, we look at spending, that data all looks very solid. And that's why we are where we are. We do still continue to think that the United States is relatively good and the dollar should hold up relatively well. We want to focus here in the United States, where we see a more stable situation versus the rest of the world, where things seem to be getting difficult, particularly in manufacturing, as you point out. We want to be very cautious about that.
One note, we created the barometer as a non-biased way of investing and tactically overweighting or underweighting risk within our portfolios. And what we do here is we're just watching and observing the data points when they're coming in. And obviously, you can tell that the Europeans, as well as China, more importantly, China, which has been the engine of growth, global growth, that is starting to decelerate. That's having a washback effect on Europe, as in particular Germany. And that is really what's driving and pulling down the diffusion index at this point.
So since you guys focus a lot on asset allocation, and this was a candidate for one of my craziest things, but I'll spit it out early, is I think it was last week we had a story looking at money market mutual funds, which I think when I edited the story, the yield on like the big federated one was something like 2.10, you know, percent. At that point, a money market yield was above the 30-year treasury yield, which I don't know if you guys have ever seen that happen. But I imagine as an asset allocator, that's the type of thing you have a nightmare about after while you have the flu and a fever, you know, is that
right?
Yeah. How do you look at that sort of opportunity set where cash is yielding more than 30-year bonds?
Yeah. It's a couple things. On the short end, and this is one of the important drivers, where the forward path of interest rates are, we would expect to have lower short-term rates over the next number of months. It just seems to us that policy is heading in that direction all over the world.
Yeah.
So that short number, that 2% number, we would expect that to come down over the next several months.
In lockstep with the Fed funds rate, I guess, to some degree.
Right. And then the other part of it, the longer end of the curve, which is between the 10 and the 30, that's a little bit unusual too, but also reflecting a lot of the pressures around the world emanating from weaker growth and all of these rate cuts around the world to see rates all along the curve come down. So ultimately, our guess at this point is that the long end sort of stabilizes, short rates come down somewhat, and so that the U.S. yield curve remains flat to relatively, some little slope in it by the time we get to, let's say, the end of the year. If, however, things get worse, which will show up in our barometer, in the data that flow that comes in, we're going to have to cut from that point of view. So our base case is that we restore some upward slope to the curve, but we're also cognizant of there's weaker things coming in from overseas, which might cause us to change our tune on that. We just haven't pulled that trigger yet.
So also on the asset allocation side, I saw you also recently raised gold to overweight. I mean, is that where that comes in, keeping track of the global economy and the buffers that we could see?
Yeah, that's exactly what we did was we wanted to take a little bit of risk off the table within the portfolio. We upped our gold allocation. We did have gold in the portfolio for the last several years. So now we're overweight gold. And as well, we took high yield down to an underweight, as well as REITs we took down to an underweight, which I know has been a popular trade. Our belief is that you don't want to be in companies right now that have a lot of debt on their balance sheet based off of what Kevin has been talking about.
Right. And how often do you sort of rebalance the portfolios? Is it a monthly thing or
Every month we go through and we look at our long-term capital market assumptions. Uh-huh. We look at what's happening in terms of what the data flow is telling us through the lens of our barometer. If we see that things are going in a way that's pointing towards recession or a more cautious posture is justified, we'll make those changes monthly. If it's going the other way, obviously we're willing to put on risk, and that's been something that barometer has been very helpful in helping us guide the portfolio tactically through good times and bad, going all the way back to 2005 when we began working with ETFs and tactical asset allocation.
So barometer at 50-50 must make it a little bit more difficult.
That's right. That's right.
That indicates stay balanced. You're in a low rate in a low return environment. And what makes us fairly unique is that we do our own long-term forecasted returns and volatility on each asset class. So that's where we should be right now.
So Chad printed out for me the numbers on the dividend, rising dividend portfolio. So this is your biggest strategy, I guess, right? Was about $1.8 billion, you said, in the strategy?
Yeah, it's about $1.7, $1.8 billion that Kevin and I manage alongside Matt Battipaglia. It's had a fairly stable type of kind of companies that we're looking for, the companies that are consistently growing, consistently profitable. The general thematic here, which makes us fairly unique, is that we don't like companies that have a lot of debt on their balance sheet. So you're not going to see overweight within financials. And for a value manager or rising dividend manager, most dividend managers or value managers are overweight financials or MLPs or whatnot.
Speaking of debt, I will say Goldman Sachs put out a research note earlier this week pointing out that net leverage for the S&P 500 is now at a record high. So all the more reason to really be thinking about that.
Yeah, well, we agree with their assessment. Everywhere we look, debt has increased, and debt has increased in the financial system globally. When I began in the business in the early 1990s, debt was less than global GDP. Now it's significantly more than global GDP, and that creates some fixed costs all around the world, which can create some volatility. And in the S&P, we're going to be looking for businesses that are very consistent, going to be able to get through whatever the world throws at us in the years ahead. And also, we want to know that those businesses are conservatively financed so that they survive difficult times to be able to get through to the other side.
All right, well, I think we're about to get through to the other side of the podcast to the craziest thing we all saw in markets this week. That was a good segue.
That was a really good segue. I'm proud of you.
Yeah, working on the segues. Sarah, kick it off. What's the craziest thing you saw in markets this week?
All right, I will kick it off. This is just kind of strange. There's a headline of an article, and it says, "This ham just sold for $1 million at the Kentucky State Fair."
Oh, wait. All right. I'm gonna go out on a limb and say you win this week.
But it gets even better, because when you read through the article, there's actually a regional bank out in Kentucky called Central Bank. But the way the article reads is saying that a chief at the Central Bank bought a ham for $1 million. So I had to double check, make sure there was actually a regional bank out in Kentucky called Central Bank. No, it was not anyone in the Federal Reserve. But But quite interesting. But still, I mean, the most expensive ham, it must be.
I think I want a sandwich of that ham.
That's a good ham.
That's pretty
crazy.
Good ham, yeah.
Pretty crazy. You would hope so.
Yeah.
Better be
yeah.
good for $1 million.
Yeah.
All right. I think next, let's play. We did get a good call from our own Dave Wilson of Bloomberg Radio into the What Goes Up hotline. So let's give that a listen.
Here's something crazy. You go back to last September and take a look at Tilray, the Canadian cannabis grower. The shares reached $300 in U.S. trading. Well, now you can lop a zero off of that, and you're pretty much where the shares are now. Just this past week, they dropped below $30. Simple math tells you that's a 90% decline. As it happens, Whitney Tilson, who is a one-time fund manager now in the investment newsletter business, talked about last September how he expected the stock to drop 90%, and sure enough, it did. It's a little late for him to be able to make money off the decline, but nonetheless, it's definitely one for the books. You could say it was a stock that was high and then came down in a big way.
Ooh.
No one wants to hear that.
When you guys started at Grunnell in the early 90s, would you ever have dreamed that we'd be talking about pot stocks one day craze?
But we were talking about AOL and internet stocks at that point in time.
Shows you how things
back
changed.
In 92, 93, right?
But I will add, speaking of a Canadian pot stock, I will give you back our hotline number. And we did get some heat on Twitter from one of our podcast followers and listeners that we never say that the U.S. actually has an international code, which is 1. So I will say it this time as 1-646-324-3490.
Right. He gave us a hard time for American exceptionalism for not including that. So, all right, guys, you're in the hot seat now. What's the craziest thing that Washington Crossing Advisors has seen this week?
Well, so for me, it's the merger and acquisition of other countries into the United States.
Yes, yes. I'm glad someone brought that up.
And the M&A deals of small little countries.
Right. Up. Well, you figure it could be accretive to GDP. We can avoid that recession, just tack on a few other countries. You know, no one said it had to be organic growth, right?
Just as long as you don't buy it with debt.
It is pretty unbelievable. It seems like there is something new every single week. And this week it just happened to be Greenland.
Yeah. All right, that's a good one, Chad. Kevin, do you got
my
one?
Craziest thing would be the fact that the Danes didn't actually even consider the offer. There's half the population. There's half the size of Edison, New Jersey. So they could have done pretty well with this. They should have at least looked at the deal.
I mean, it's not the craziest idea in the world, actually. You know, is it?
No. Well, I think through history, I think there was other offers that the United States has made to actually get Greenland.
Truman, I think, right?
Yeah, back in the day.
Right. Oh boy! All right. Well, I'm gonna steal mine from a Twitter guy too. I couldn't come up with one that topped this Twitter user who goes by the initials JMT. His profile says he's a bond trader. So if you believe Twitter profiles, then he's a bond trader. I'll take him at his word. And he says anything related to Trump is assumed to be crazy and occurs every day, let alone every week. All right, fine. But he goes, but I'd go with the Porsche Type 64 Nazi car clown show auction at Sotheby's.
Oh, yeah.
I read that and I had no idea what he was talking about. I had to look this up. It's insane.
I saw the headline earlier this week, but I didn't look at the details until recently.
Right.
My understanding of it was it was a botched auction.
Yeah.
And the car was supposed to go for an awful lot and the auctioneer botched it. And it was,
didn't sell.
It was, so it said 1939 Type 64 Porsche. Believed to be actually the first Porsche ridden by Ferdinand Porsche himself. And they had a Dutch auctioneer and no one could understand his accent. So he's meant to say bidding starting at 17 million. And instead he said 70 million and the whole crowd got up and everyone went crazy. They're clapping and taking pictures like, oh my gosh, this car is going to sell for at least 70 million. And then he said, wait, no, I got that wrong. It's 17 million. And the place, it sounds like there was almost a riot. They all got up and started booing them and left. So they had to cancel the auction. So
brutal.
That's pretty good.
Mm. Absolutely brutal.
So thanks to our Twitter guy, JMT, for that one.
But with that said, bad auction, but hopefully good podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Anyways, Kevin Karen, Chad Morgenlander, thanks so much for joining us.
And a bad German bund auction, too, this week, too. So they, I don't know if the two are related, but it's a bad week for German auctions.
Same guy, maybe.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, website, and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek, Mike is at Reaganonymous, and Washington Crossing Advisors is at Stiefel WCA. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Thank you.